Accession number 26868, reel 3.
This is the second reel of a taped interview with Max Gamble in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 23rd of the 12th, 2003, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Max, you're talking about some of the planes, and in particular the ME-109, which was obviously a plane to look out for. Can we talk about your early training period in Rhodesia and what that involved?
Right, well, I think I better go back a little bit behind, earlier than that. I got to Bulawayo by train from Durban and then went into a transit camp, and the delay there was waiting for an opportunity to go to a training school. There were two elementary flying schools in Rhodesia and two senior flying schools. Unfortunately, in the wait there, I got a bug in my throat, and I couldn't hear. I couldn't speak very well, and I was stuffed into hospital, and eventually they took my tonsils out, and they made such a job of pulling them out that I couldn't speak properly for 3 months. So that delayed my training. So then when I could speak enough to be able to be heard over the intercom, which was just a pipe in the Tiger Moths, I was sent to 27 EFTS at Induna in southern part of Rhodesia, southern Rhodesia, and started flying on Tiger Moths. I think that Tiger Moth period was one of the happiest in my life. I really had a good time. I enjoyed it. I found I could fly pretty well, and I had my second instructor was rather an adventurous type, so we had a lot of fun together, and it improved the flying. Now the 27 EFTS was one that normally produced pilots to go on to the bomber school, the senior flying school, but they reckoned my flying was not for bombers, and they said, right, we're going to send you to the singles one. So when I finished that, I was sent to Thornhill, which was 22 SFTS, that's Senior Flying Training School.
In relation to bombers and single fighters, for instance, how were they seen? What was the most popular?
I don't know, a lot of it was individual choice, but they generally put the really good pilots onto single engines and the ones in the more mediocre class onto bombers. That was the general rule, although there were a lot of individual personal exceptions on that. A lot of times you had no choice. But I always wanted to go on to singles, so it all worked out.
In your opinion, what made a good pilot then?
Well, it was, a lot of it was an inbuilt ability and training up that ability and the very quick reactions. Not only did you have to be a pilot, but you had to be able to navigate pretty well too. Otherwise, you're just a damn nuisance, as I found later when I was more senior in operations, when you got these damn pilots who couldn't fly from A to B without getting lost. So I went to Thornhill, which was the planes used there were the Harvard, which is called the Texan out here nowadays. It was a good aircraft as a trainer for single-engined aircraft because it had a few little vices which made people more alert. For instance, if you're coming into land and you did not get your height right and so on, and the speed dropped too much, it had the ability to drop one wing quickly and boom, it hit the ground on one wheel and then go around like that, and then be an undercarriage repair. So it made people alert. Its performance was fairly reasonable as a trainer. I enjoyed doing all sorts of things, particularly the aerobatics and vertical rolls and various things like that, so that you became part of the plane. So everything you did was automatic, instinctive. Well, about halfway through the training at Thornhill, I was moved into the officer's mess as a trainee, so I was in there, which really meant that if everything went per plan, I'd be commissioned as soon as I got my wings. Well, I got so far on with the training, about two-thirds of the way through, and I was on a cross-country, which was a long one. It was the longest one in the whole training schedule, solo, when I had an appendicular attack in the air, and I was just as far away as I could be from base. So I got back. We didn't have wirelesses in those days which would carry the distance. So when I got back to the field, I saw there was nothing on the field. I landed straight to the apron and stopped, which was against regulations, doing it that way, but I didn't know when I might pass out. So I did it as quickly as I could. Well, people rushed up to arrest me and so on. I just said, look, get the ambulance, get somebody to get me out of here because I can't. Well, that really stopped it. Thing and I finished up in hospital, and they took my appendix out, so then I had another delay of 3 weeks, I think it was, in my training, and then I continued on, got my wings, and was commissioned.
What did it feel like to get your wings?
Sense of achievement. And on the way, one thing I must put in was that Rhodesia was a very good place for the training of pilots because they had what they called their gooty, which was an early morning mist caused by the high pressure going out over the Indian Ocean and bringing in this mist, which was up to 500 feet thick and so on. And as a trainee, you didn't worry about that. You took off when you couldn't see halfway down the runway or the field. And you had to find your way back. And it helped one's cloud flying, which was sadly lacking in a lot of training schools. And in addition to that, there was what they used to call the link trainer, which was a little thing which had airbags and so on, and they'd put on, you had an ordinary instrument panel and so on, and you had to try and control this thing. And there were air pumps and so on to make it appear like rough weather. And you had to sort of even it out and do turns and so on. And it was a great aid to flying in cloud. Because the odd thing is, when you go into cloud, if you do not watch your artificial horizon, you can be upside down and you don't know it. So in cloud, everything, you can't feel that you're upside down or that you're this way or that way. All you've got to do is this little artificial horizon, which is like a little plane and the horizon there. And if it's like that, well, it means you're turning that way. And I found that the link trainer, I did my full hours. A lot of people were inclined to say, oh, this is ruddy rubbish, this isn't flying. But it stood me in good stead later on, which I'll come to. due course.
Let's talk about the situation in relation to... You mentioned the skills required to be a good pilot. Obviously, you can fly a plane, but you need to be able to fly it well if you're going to have a good chance of coming out of a dogfight, for instance.
Well, there are two opposing things come in here. In learning to fly, you've got to be accurate, and you don't need to skid this way, and you've got your ball in the middle, and you want to keep there, you don't want to be skidding this or that way, particularly when it comes to formation flying. But having said that, when you got onto squadrons, and if you were in combat with the Germans, the last thing you did was accurate flying, because you were a much easier target to shoot down. You did all, was split-arse flying, skidding this way, doing everything to put the gunner off, because you're heading that way and going that way, and this sort of thing. So you can see the two opposing factors there.
Was that a fun thing to be doing all the time, or is it tedious in a way?
Well, it was a certain amount of fun, and a lot of it was when, if you thought about it, well, if your life's depending on it, it's a good idea to be able to do it properly. The other thing was recovery from spins and spinning to the left, spinning to the right, because if you were in a dogfight, there was a big chance that you might deliberately spin out of it to put the other chap off because he'd go past, or accidentally do so, and you needed to be able to do the right things to recover as quickly as possible. Now, later on in my career in the Air Force, I was instructing at Operational Training Unit, and I had about 300 or 400 hours on Harvard aircraft, and I had a couple of pupils come in. They'd been instructors in South Africa, and they had about 3,000 hours, and I was to instruct them on this, you see. So I said, well, this is a little bit ironical, but have you done spins? And I could see they didn't like this. So I said, right, well, this is in the curriculum, you've got to bloody well do it. Well, they'd never done it, because in South Africa they reckoned if you did that, you'd never come out. And that was what they taught all the pilots. So when I took these chaps, I said, right, spin to the right. And they hesitated, so I'd kick the rudder and the damn thing would go into a spin and then tell them how to come out of it. And they were happy then. So then do it the other way. And I think it possibly saved their lives by doing that. But that was an aside.
What about things like accidents? Did they occur often in training?
Yes, there were quite a few. The first funeral I attended was at the EFTS, where one chap, I had to go to the funeral. He hit the ground and it burned up. So quite a number did that. On the Harvards, as I think I mentioned earlier, they were a good training plane because they used to have a few little vices which made people keep on their toes. This one day was just happened to be Friday the 13th, and all the chaps were saying, boy, there'll be some crashes today. Well, up to 2 o'clock, everything was going fine. And by 20 past 2, there were 3 partial wrecks on the field. It was very hot, a lot of heat rising. They'd come into land, and as they landed, the rising heat took them up. And so instead of being a few feet off the ground, they were way up. And then they stalled, and then down they went on one wing, and but those weren't dangerous one, because all that happened was the undercarriage collapsed on one side and it was repairable.
To what degree were pilots superstitious, would you say?
Oh, just a sort of run of the crowd, more or less. There was one interesting one there where a chap had not done night flying, and the Harvard had a big exhaust pipe right on the side, which you couldn't, well, in daylight you couldn't see the exhaust coming back beside the cockpit. Well, he was supposed to do an air test, and it got darker and darker, and it got a bit dark, and he carried on, and he was taking off, looking as one normally did from the left-hand side. It was just a thing over the nose. He looked this side and he saw this great rush of flame like a blowtorch going past him. He thought, God, I'm on fire! He quickly opened the hood, or he had the hood open, pulled off his thing and jumped out. All it was the normal exhaust, which when you did night flying you had to get used to. In fact, you didn't look over that side because you were blinded by the exhaust at night. Anyway, that was an incident.
What happened to people who made mistakes, brought a precious plane down?
Well, there was an inquiry, and if there was a reasonable excuse for what had gone on, well, that was that. If there wasn't, they either got an endorsement in the logbook or they were reclassified to become a navigator or an air gunner. So that was it. Now,
well, I was wanting to talk a little bit about that side of things and how pilots were seen in relation to those that were good and those that weren't so good. How did you interact with one another?
Oh, it was that really didn't come into it very much. One didn't really know, apart from your own sort of observation of and what your instructor said until you'd finished the course, and then you got a below average, average or above average rating. That was it.
So if someone got a below average, how was he seen by those that perhaps got an above average?
If he was below average a fighter training lot, he was usually transferred onto bombers.
So if he'd been placed as a tail gunner, for instance, in a bomber, how was he seen?
By others? Usually about the bravest man on the bloody plane, because they had a pretty rough time. They were the first one to get shot at, and they were away from the others. There was one case where, this was on Wellington's, where the tail gunner didn't realise what had happened, and he wasn't in communication because of the various things had been shot up. What had happened? The pilot had given the order to bail out. They all bailed out except the rear gunner, who was still going on. And when the plane made a hell of a rough landing, he started to scream about this and then found he was the only person on the ruddy plane. It had landed itself in UK. Well, one or two examples of that.
Coming to talk about those sorts of experiences, we'll come to your experience in relation to your first operations shortly. I wanted to discuss things like gremlins. Were they ever discussed? Things that might go wrong with the plane that couldn't quite be explained away.
It did happen. Not much. I had it once on a hurricane where the brake on one wheel wouldn't work, And then after it, it worked. And there it was. The brake was necessary to try and keep straight in a crosswind. Now, that didn't happen very much. There was an odd superstition in that I remember one notice going up on the notice board to saying that the pissing on undercarriages for luck will cease forthwith owing to the corrosive action. That was in Rhodesia.
So you were obviously on Harvard aircraft. What was your dream craft to fly?
At that time it was the Spitfire. So, and that was the sort of more or less the next one with the Hurricane in between and then the Spitfire.
Well, so can we talk then about the Harvard and how it compared to the Hurricane, and the Hurricane and how it compared to the Spitfire then?
Right. Well, I think I better mention going on to the next part of the training.
Okay.
Because of the Japanese in the war, they were a little bit worried about the east coast of Africa with shipping being torpedoed. And as they were short of single-engine pilots in the Middle East, they decided to send all but 30 of us, I think, all together, more or less overland to Cairo, which meant train from Rhodesia through northern Rhodesia into the Congo, as it was, and then hundreds of miles in open trucks east in the Congo, till we got to Lake Tanganyika, crossed Lake Tanganyika in the ferry, got into the East African Railways and Harbours Railway, which then took us to Musoma at the southern end of Lake Victoria, and then the steamer on Lake Victoria to Kisumu in Kenya. There we were stopped because from there was no direct connection and we had to wait for the aircraft, which was Imperial Airways flying boat. That was the forerunner of BOAC and British Airways, which was still flying as a commercial aircraft from UK to South Africa. We had a couple of weeks stop in Kisumu and then we got on the plane and flew to Kampala, or Entebbe, Kampala in Uganda, spent the night, and then on in the plane to the swamps of the Nile, where we landed on the Nile, a place called Malakal, and then on to Khartoum, where the aircraft went US. So we continued on from there and Sudan Railways to Wadi Halfa. Wadi Halfa got onto the Nile steamer up to the Egyptian border and Egyptian railways from Shalal to Cairo. So arrived in Cairo, went into the transit camp at Al-Maza. Not long after that, was sent again by train from Al-Maza to, that's some of us, to 74 Operational Training Unit at Akia in Palestine, as it was then that. There was no Israel then. And that's where I then started training, operational training, on Harvard and had, I think, two flights on a Spitfire One. It was the first model of Spitfire, which you had to pump up the undercarriage by hand. after you took off. So you'd see a plane going along like this. Is the chap pumping into an opposite reaction on the control? But most of the training was on hurricanes.
So how did the hurricane compare to Harvard?
Oh, it was entirely different.
In what way?
Well, you see, it had a Merlin engine, the earlier Merlin. So the engine power had gone up over double, and its whole performance was very much different. It was surprising what one could do with a Hurricane. It had a great thick wing, so it didn't have much speed, really, but it had a lot of manoeuvrability. And later on, when we're training other pilots in the air gunnery, we used to have to tow a drogue, you know, it's a thing like a windsock behind which they were shooting at. And to get the drogue off the ground before it was torn to pieces, the rope was curled, or wire was curled out like that, and you had to open up full throttle on brakes, let it go until it hit 85 miles an hour, pull the stick right back and go like that, and then when it was about to stall, push it forward, and by that time then the drogue was supposed to hit and come up. When you saw this happen the first time, I think that I'm seeing things, but you could do it. But it was near disaster all the time on that. But it was great using that, air gunnery, bombing, and generally learning what to do in odd situations. Another thing that was taught, which was aerial photography, both vertical line overlap, the focus was straight down through the plane, or oblique overlap, which you're taking, you had a marker on the side of the wing, which corresponded with the angle of the camera. I'll come to that later. So that was quite interesting, and also doing low flying and so on. Low flying was such that on a maize crop you were touching the top of the maize, because after all your own safety depended on that one. But what was not really done or allowed was stupid split-arse flying, because all that happened was a pilot was lost and the plane was ridden off. So that's the main sort of thing in the AOTU.
Talk about what you were about to mention with the camera and the Hurricane.
It was a camera on a Spitfire later, so that'll come on in when we go on to the squadron I was on. Mm-hmm.
Were you aware at this stage of how the war was developing? Obviously you heard the Japanese were in the war. But how are things in North Africa going for the Germans at this stage?
By this time, Montgomery was getting well ahead. When I was in Egypt earlier on the transit to training, things were not looking at all well.
Well, let's talk about that. This is leading up to Alamein, I would presume.
Yeah, that was about it, yeah. A lot of this was censored, and you could only just hear from word of mouth and the odd little bit of news that was dished out. But it was a bit chaotic in Egypt at that time. One of the stories, which I think was true, was King Farouk wasn't being very cooperative, and previous generals didn't do much about it. But when Montgomery took over, he decided to alter things, so he went to see the king. And the king wasn't being very cooperative, so he said, "I think you'd better have a look out the window." And out the window there was a line of tanks. And he said, "If I go to the window and wave my arms, they'll be in here, through that gate and everything else. You've got one option. You agree." And he did. He did. Later on, I had to train some Egyptian pilots, because that was in the agreement that of the airfields in Egypt and the transit camps and so on.